The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
The 2nd Ranger Infantry Company Airborne was the U.S. Army's first and only all-black Ranger unit. As part of President Truman's integration of the Army, they were attached to the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team in Korea. They were the first Ranger company ever to parachute into battle. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, guest host Paul Berry sits down with Sergeant Herculano Diaz, Staff Sergeant Winston Jackson, Corporal Richard Briscoe, and First Sergeant Donald Allen, all members of the famed 2nd Ranger Infantry Company, as they discuss military integration, racism, and the struggles of combat in Korea.
Gentlemen, I presume, and I'll start with the First Sergeant, because rank has its privilege.
Yes, sir.
All right. Were all of these men in the service when President Truman made the that order that he was going to integrate? Were all of you in the service at the time?
Yes.
We were all, but we were stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We had just graduated from the 555 to the 3rd Battalion, 505, 82nd Airborne Division.
Except me.
He was not in the Army then.
Okay, Winston wasn't in the Army yet.
Right.
You were the young man in the group, I guess.
I was the drafted.
You were the,
the drafted.
All right, but you were coming into the Army about that time or thereafter.
In 1950.
The reason I asked that question, Richard, was how did it feel? How did you feel for the first time here? Your president said, "Okay, no more of the separate, no more of the segregation. You're all in this together." But the question I asked, were you really in it together at that point?
No, definitely not.
Definitely not.
Oh, we were.
We didn't get into it, definitely. I said, till we got overseas during the Korean War.
Okay, but at that point, the order had come that it was desegregation.
Yeah, right.
But the reality was, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Until 1951, when. Our company was all black company. In 1951, when all the Ranger companies were detached, I guess is the word, and they integrated us into the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team, that's when our integration happened.
Right. So, Winston, you were drafted after this order, so you came in too.
I was in the second draft of 1950. I think we was the first group to integrate. First cycle to go through basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Integrated.
In October of 50.
Herc, what was it like back then? I mean, was it, you were fighting, you'd already fought racism, and you were continuing to fight racism.
And you're talking about overseas?
Before you even got over there.
In the States, it was the same. I mean, the law was passed, Truman passed the law, but we still, we rode the back of the bus. We had, only certain places you could go into town.
So it didn't open up. People didn't welcome you with open arms.
It was in June, I believe, when President Truman put out that word. And I like Truman. When he put out the word, the only hint that we had of his order was we were told about the integration. It was no movement whatsoever. Now, this was in 48?
Mm-hmm, 48.
All right. When we got to Korea, we went as a black unit. There was no integration. And I think we got the word again from President Truman that he wanted the units integrated. And he said what he meant by that was a black guy and a white guy in a hole. He didn't mean one unit over here and 2 miles over a black unit. That's not what he meant. Now, we went to a couple of meetings down on New Jersey Avenue, and we talked to some colonels that were in the Pentagon. When that order was put out, and the word, some of them said, that we probably get in trouble for telling you this, but they said, some of our commanders, the generals and things, said, I will give up my commission before I integrate my unit. And that's the word that we got from people who were there when he put out the order.
So you gentlemen were still, despite the order, still fighting
racism.
Yeah. Oh, sure. in service.
Still riding in the back of the bus.
They had a situation in 187 Airborne before we got there. There were 9 black enlisted men had to report to 187. And their first sergeant was also named Sergeant West, where our first sergeant was. And they had these 9 men out in the cold, standing out in the cold, while they're in trying to decide what to do with them. And finally, one white officer says, these guys are airborne. Get them out of the cold. And that's how they started. From what I read in the history of the 187, these were the first blacks integrated into the 187 Airborne.
I'm going to tell you something that happened to me.
Go ahead, Richard. Richard Briscoe speaking.
I had gotten discharged from the Army January the 7th. So I stayed in Washington for about a week. I'm going down to the country now. I go to the bank, draw some money up, carry my discharge and everything with me. I said, well, I'm out. I said, I'll go down to the bus station and get my ticket so I won't have to be getting it later on. Greyhound bus station on New York Avenue. I go down there, and I saw the lieutenant, and I saw a corporal was with him. The corporal came up to me and said, Lieutenant, I'd like to see you over there. I know why he called me. I had the 2nd Airborne Ranger patch on my left, the 7th Division, and had the 187th Airborne patch on my right. And he didn't believe that were black Rangers. I said, I know why you called me over here, because you didn't believe what you saw on my shoulder. But here's my discharge paper. He looked at it, gave it back to me. He didn't say nothing, period. I was just going on.
And you had been fought in Korea.
Yeah.
You fought in combat. You earned your rape and your stripes and your stars. And here you were being treated like?
Like I was second-class soldier, period.
So, gentlemen, that brings up this question. You all are in the Army. You know what discrimination is, and yet all of you volunteer to be Rangers, which is what you do, and paratroopers.
Yes, sir.
Why would you do that? Why would you?
I didn't volunteer at this point. I'll tell you how I got hooked up in it. We were the first group to integrate Fort Jackson, so therefore I think we were the first or second cycle to go through basic training. I went in the Army October 4th of 1950. Then they had 13 weeks of basic training. From there, they sent me to Seattle, Washington, to get on a boat to go to Japan. From Japan, they sent me to Korea, to the replacements company. While I was in the replacements company, Lieutenant Queen, which is our second ranger, he was from Washington, D.C., and I recognized him. I guess they were looking. They just came back. I heard that they just came back from combat. Now, they need some replacement. So he asked us, so I volunteered to go. The reason why I volunteered to go, now, I went in the Army in October, and now I'm in March. I'm going in on the fighting line. So I said to myself, and I was a squad leader in Fort Jackson. I said to myself, they just came back for combat, and I'm going to volunteer to go with them.
Because they know what they're doing.
Yeah. So then as he was getting to leave, he said, oh, one more catch. He said, now, in case they had to jump, we had to jump with them without any training. See, that was the catch.
So that's how you got here.
And that's how I got there.
Right. And yet you others, despite all the drawbacks, chose to do the...
We volunteered because it was the best thing out there. At first, we were the best being paratroopers. And then somebody come along and said, we're going to form some Rangers. So what's a Ranger? We didn't know. So when they told us what a Ranger, I want to go. I want to go to the Rangers. Now, when I first joined the Rangers, it was seven Allens there, including the company commander. The company commander died down at Fort Bragg there, so I'm the only one that's left. We lost most of our men. But I remember one time when Captain Allen told me we was having hand-to-hand combat. You know, you don't want to throw your buddy down too hard. You might break something. So we was kind of playing around there at 7 o'clock in the morning in the sun. And Captain Allen came out there. He said, Allen, what are you doing? We're not playing games. And I said, no, sir. And all of a sudden, he grabbed me and flipped me down and caught me by surprise. And I said to myself, nobody could flip me down. So I jumped up, and I said, okay, sir, my turn. I'm going to try you. He said, oh, no, I'm too busy. And it took me years to learn what he meant by that. But he knew that I was ready for him. So he caught me by surprise, and I learned more about Captain Allen. Captain Allen said, we're the only Black Ranger company, but nobody's going to beat us. Now, we were the best until one thing. We learned to swim down in the Potomac River. I lost a lot of buddies trying to swim down there. Okay. He said, we're going to do everything better than those guys. Now, we had a river crossing, a Victory Pond. And you had, it was in, was it November, I believe it was?
Yeah,
and it was ice around there. They said we had to cross there. And up until this time, everybody had said, I can swim. I can swim. But when it comes time to put up and shut up, everybody can't swim. That's the only thing I remember that we got beat on, was crossing that water.
When Veterans Chronicles returns, the men of the 2nd Ranger Company discuss the difficulties of combat in one of Korea's coldest winters.
During the Korean War, American troops, supported by allies from 21 nations, fought valiantly at places like the Pusan Perimeter, Incheon, and the Chosin Reservoir. We must always remember our veterans who fought in Korea to preserve freedom. Between now and 2013, the Department of Defense will commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Korean War to thank our Korean War veterans and their families for their selfless service and sacrifice, bringing freedom and prosperity to the Korean Peninsula. To learn how you can join the Department of Defense 60th anniversary of the Korean War Commission in its mission to honor our Korean War vets, visit http://koreanwar.defense.gov.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Despite their rigorous training, the members of the 2nd Ranger Infantry Company were not prepared for the freezing temperatures they encountered in Korea. The discussion continues as the men describe the cold reality of combat.
Gentlemen, you all now find yourself in Korea. As a unit, right? You're in the same unit.
Right.
You're paratroopers, you're Rangers.
Right.
You are, in fact, the first, last, and only all-Black Ranger team, right?
Yes.
How long have you been in Korea together now? You've been there, when you get there when?
We got there December 1950, and we left there August 51, around eight months.
All right. I got there in March of 51.
And joined the same unit.
Yeah.
All right. That's Winston. Winston Jackson got there in March. Kirk, you got there. You guys were.
We got there in December 50, which was. We heard that. We found out later that it was one of the coldest winters they had in Korea in 900 years. Anyhow, we went over there with 110 men and five officers. By the end of January, we were like maybe down to 65 men. We had so much frostbite. We were ill-equipped. We had a lot of men with frostbite. I was one. Went to the hospital, came back. We had guys with frostbite who never came back. They were so severe. Then, of course, by the end of January, we had
we had lost, I guess, 8 or 9 killed in action, a big amount of men wounded. So we were undermanned.
What were your thoughts, gentlemen, while you? I mean, what was your spirits like? What does it feel like? What were you like while you were there? Go ahead, Donald Allen.
I learned a lot on the ship going over. They said that it was a lot of National Guard that was on the ship with us. So you Rangers know what you're doing. Can you give them some training? So we said yes. I think they gave me about 20 men. So I'm armed with the Browning automatic rifle. This is a 30 caliber weapon, but it's got a big flash hider on the end. So I had the guy sitting down. We're sitting down on the side of the ship, and the guy says, "Sarge," he says, "that's a mighty big weapon you got there. What's that, a 40 millimeter?" And I said, "No, strange question." I said, "It's a 30. That's a flash hider. Keep the enemy from seeing what." Oh, okay. So I said, "Okay, but I'm going to give you a little bit about your M1 rifle, and then I'm going to cover this weapon that I got you, the BAR."
Who were you talking to? These were soldiers on the boat?
On the way to Korea.
National Guard.
On that ship that didn't know how to take apart a rifle. They were going to combat.
Were they black or white?
White.
These were white soldiers, mostly white.
We had men on that ship going to war, did not know how to use a P-38, which was a can opener. I asked one of the guys, "Sarge, can you show me how to use this?" I said, "Didn't you ever go on bivouac? Didn't you ever go on maneuvers?"
They hadn't.
"Yes, we did go, but we had hot chow." Mm-hmm. They didn't know how to use that. Imagine that going to war. That's why we were fortunate. And we were highly, highly trained.
You guys were highly trained. You get there. Richard, you get into the... What was your first big battle, Richard?
First big battle was the 3rd of January.
That's were you scared, Richard?
Damn, I was scared. Tanyang. Any man goes in combat, say he's not scared, he's telling a lie, and he wants to die. Because, see, no man... like Allen here, or Jackson, or Diaz, we all go in combat. We don't know how each other would react. You don't even know how you would react in combat until you get there. No man knows how another man is going to react in combat. You don't even know how you're going to react yourself. Mm-hmm. I was scared. Damn right I was scared. I was scared like hell.
That battle, how many men did you lose, Richard? Do you know?
We had 8 or 9 killed in action, and we had about 15 wounded on that day. That was the biggest casualty day for us.
Winston, where were you?
Huh?
Were you?
I was in basic training in Fort Jackson.
So you hadn't gotten to that yet?
Not yet.
Okay. And Donald, you were in that, right?
Yes.
I was in there, and I seen most of these guys die. I saw so many dead bodies, I could not believe it. And I had my old supply sergeant, because he wasn't supply sergeant now, Daniel Boatwright. He made colonel. He'd come up, and this kid had just got killed in my arm. And I tried to, I remember thinking, the man needs a chaplain. Then I said, we don't have no chaplain. Then I said to myself, well, let me say a little something for him. And I remember saying, God is grace and God is good. Then I thought about it. I said, wait a minute. That's a blessing for the food. So I say, well, I guess somebody will understand. The boy was dead. And he got shot in the foot. And then about 5 rounds they hit him. And then that's when Boatwright came up. And Boatwright said, oh, man, throw some lead on that hill. So they're all over the place up there. And by that time, it was about 15 dead guys laying around in the snow. So about that time, Boatwright said, throw some lead up there, man. Throw some lead up there. And then he hollered, oh, I'm hit. I'm hit. And I said, hot dog, they got Boatwright. So a little while later, hadn't been 2 minutes, Boatwright said, oh, they got me again. They got, I'm hit twice, man. He said, but keep throwing lead up there. He said, because we still fight.
The veterans of the 2nd Ranger Company describe parachuting into Moonsan-ni, Korea, and the battles that followed when Veterans Chronicles returns.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. In this segment, the members of the 2nd Ranger Infantry Company detail what it was like to be the first Rangers in history to parachute into battle.
All right, gentlemen, let's continue. I want to get to that battle that you guys parachuted in, the first and only time I think that's happened. Where was that?
Moonsan-ni, Korea. It was a little above the 38th parallel. We were attached to the 108. It was a big jump, a whole regiment.
How many may we talking about?
3,000 in the regiment. And they attached two ranger companies, the Black 2nd Ranger Company and our brother company, the 4th Ranger Company. We were attached to them for this combat jump. As a matter of fact, that morning when we were getting on the planes, it was like about an hour ride, and I think it was Jim Aquino, one of the officers said, "Gentlemen, today we're going to make history." I remember that. And there it was.
And you see, we were the first Rangers to ever jump in combat. They had Rangers during World War II, but they wasn't airborne. We were the first Rangers, 2nd and 4th Ranger Company, first Rangers to ever jump in combat. And that was on Good Friday. I don't know whether it was Good Friday, but
had March then.
It was March 23rd, which was Good Friday.
And you all knew that you were going to make a jump that you might not come back from.
Oh, sure.
You knew that.
Well, definitely.
I went to marching there for about a week.
We had one of our, a guy that I went to jump school, it was in my jump school class. That was quite a battle, but we were lucky because we only had one man killed in action. We had maybe 7 wounded, and we must have killed 60 or 70 of them and captured at least 20. But the man I'm talking about, I went to jump school. I mean, we ended up in A Battery in 80th Airborne Aircraft. And he was one of our replacements, and this was his first day in combat that he was killed. The one man that we lost that day, William Van Dyke.
And he was in B Battery.
A and B Battery, yeah.
He was in B Battery.
PFC William Van Dyke.
Van Dyke.
From New York.
Yeah. Van Dyke was a member of the Ramapo tribe. Van Dyke, if you saw Van Dyke walking down the street with me, you'd figure I was with a white guy. But Van Dyke was from the Ramapo Indians, which were mixed with Dutch, black, and white. It happened years later when we found out where he was buried. I start going up to his grave in Airmont, New York, on the 23rd of March, and on Veterans Day. And I left notes there in plastic on his grave.
What did your note say?
Pardon me?
What did your note say?
Just call me. You know, I was with Bill. And I met 3 of his brothers, his sister-in-law, and the chief of the tribe. And unfortunately, what happens in combat, people don't know. All our guys came back like 6 months after they were killed. His family had no idea what happened to him.
When you say all of our guys came back, you mean?
Our killed in action.
The bodies were.
It was like 6 months later before. Now the guys get killed, they're back home like the next day. But
back then,
it was like 6 months. And then I asked his family, did you know what happened to him? No, all they knew, he was a parrot. They didn't even know he was a ranger. So over the years, I got a lot of information to his family.
Let me tell you about the jump. I remember just like it was yesterday. Now, during World War II, the 82nd and the 101st, they were jumping all over the place. And a lot of them was as much as 10 miles away from their objective. We started off, we went to Marshan area. made mock-ups of the hills of our objective in all of this. We trained. We cleaned our weapons. Okay, on the day of the jump, before the planes took off, they dropped leaflets. And I had one of the leaflets, but it says, it's got a leaflet with a parachute on there. It said, run or die. The paratroopers are coming from the sky. You remember that? And you couldn't see the sky. There's parachutes all over the place. And so help me, when I went out the door at 10 minutes past 10, when I went out that door, and when you went out to the door.
You mean out the airplane door.
Out the airplane. And you could see people running around on the ground. You could hear the bullet. Zoop, zoop, zoop. They're going all past your head and everything. Just let me get on the ground. Just let me get on the ground. And we had learned before that time to take our bayonets. The bayonets were black, what you call blue in, to keep them from rusting, okay? We put the bayonets down in the sand, took all the blowing off so they were nice and shiny. And we learned that when you wave that bayonet in the air and you holler buffalo and you went up that hill, 9 times out of 10, the enemy was gone. What about it, dear?
Mm-hmm. Huh? I agree.
They were gone. Sometimes we get up on the hill, like in the jump. When we went up the hill, we got to the top of the hill. You could see them running down the other side. They had machine gun boxes stacked up like this.
Left them and ran.
When they saw us coming, what they call us, the dark-skinned fellas with the hair like steel wool. And they said, they ain't got no sense. Say they come up that hill hollering, buffalo. And you know, when we start up the hill, we went all the way up the hill.
Yeah, that day, the second company, we took the highest hill in the area.
Was that Hill 151?
On Moonsani.
No.
Yeah, that was 151, right?
No.
Yeah. But at Moonsani, we did take the highest hill in the area. I can't remember the name of the number of it right now.
What was the ground like? What was the weather like?
Cold,
yeah. As a matter of fact, we had these chin straps that go on your helmet. I didn't have one. I couldn't find one. I made one out of a bandolier, cloth from bandolier. When I got my opening shot, my helmet was gone. I landed on the side of the hill with some short trees. I got no helmet. I said, Lord, I'm in big trouble now. And I saw a guy laying down. He was moaning and groaning. I said, you hit? He was not hit. I said, brother, I need this more than you. I said, you'll be out of here soon. And I put on the helmet. You're talking about cold. That night when we finally took off the helmet, me and Hargrove, the whole, and I took off the helmet, there was a pair of socks in there. I said, Lord, I found gold. A pair of socks.
Inside the helmet.
In that helmet, man. Yes, Lord.
How many battles did you fight over there that you recall?
I fought all of them. I didn't miss none.
We were in three major battles.
Three major battles.
But we had a lot of fog. We had a lot of fog fights.
It was more than this. Y'all made more than three. No, I was in three.
Every day we were there, you were out on patrol. Right. You know, every day. And at night, you can't sleep. You're in the hold.
Sometimes the enemy, you have to go look for him. You know, I said to myself, what the hell are we going to look for him for? I don't want to find him. You know?
Still get destroyed.
Yeah. The enemy, you might not see him or he might not fight with you, fight against you for about 45, 50 days. Then you got to go find him to see what he's up to, you know? I didn't want to find him to hell with him.
Paul, let me tell you about the steel helmet. Steel. You remember when we first got there, we had soft caps. Now, the soft caps, because we're supposed to be sneaking through the woods and everything, quiet. Steel helmet and brush make all kind of noise. And I think the first battle, and the reason we had steel helmets was because this general, Feuerbach. He said, all my men will wear helmets. Now, we said, we don't wear helmets. He said, you will. So we had helmets when we went up into the pass. I saw we had moved forward, and Lieutenant Pryor, my platoon leader, had gotten ahead of me. I don't know how he got in front of me. He come back across this hill, and there was a hole in the top of that helmet. It was above his head, but the bullet come down and split his skull from front to rear. And I told a buddy of mine, I said, Billy, look, that Lieutenant Pryor. I said, he dead and just don't know it. So Billy said, no, he not dead. So I said, come on, let's go get him. And we went up there. About that time, he fell down on his knees, blood running all down his face. Sir, can you make it? And he said, yeah, I'll try to make it. So about that time, a medic was coming by. Sergeant Lanier, you remember? Was it
Johnny? Yeah, it was in the hole with him, yeah.
Lanier had a stretcher and an aid bag. And we said, hey, medic, medic. And Lanier was holding his head up like this.
Right in his ear.
He's got his ear shot off. He said, I'm hitting myself. And we said, well, what about the stretcher? He said, here. He threw the stretcher in the aid bag. So we got Fry on that stretcher. We never took his helmet off. Couldn't see his head, but the blood was running all down his face. And we carried him down out of there, and the only reason he got hit was because of that helmet.
Wearing a helmet.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, you distinguished yourselves. There's no question about that. You even won awards that you were not even given. But perhaps I imagine the biggest discredit, the thing that must have hurt you most, is when they disbanded. After all that you had done, why did they do that?
When we got there, we weren't doing the job we were trained for. Each division used us as they had us out front. They had us doing a regular infantry company, which has like 240 men. We only had 110 men. They had us doing a regular infantry thing. When you had a handful of casualties, you don't have a force. It ended up that the people in Washington, the generals in Washington, said, well, the guys are not there doing what they're supposed to do. They took so many casualties, they broke them all up and said it would be better to have them with their range of training integrated in different outfits, and they could spread their knowledge with them.
How'd you feel about that, Richard?
I'll tell you what. When we was back in the States, we were trained to go behind enemy lines, blow up ammunition dump, cut out communication system. I think we did it one time. But ordinarily, we fought up on the line just like an ordinary infantry company would fight.
Why?
Because they needed us.
They needed us up on that line because then again, when we went overseas, after we got up on the line, I tell you what they did to us. We'd go up with one battalion. Battalion might stay up there couple weeks. That battalion would come back to the rear. We would still be up there, and then another battalion come up there and replace them. We would still be up on that line. We'd be up on that line sometimes 72 days.
They replaced the battalion, but they wouldn't replace you.
No.
Why?
No. We fought with every regiment in the 7th Division, 31st, 32nd, and 17th.
17.
Here's the thing when you talk about a battalion. In the regiment, there's three battalions, all right? They send one back. You still got to go fight with the other two that are still
Why?
There.
Why, gentlemen?
Because they wanted us out in front.
Yeah. Then again, I think it was prejudice, too.
They had National Guard. We were not National. Let me tell you about a patrol we ran one time.
We're just almost out of time, very quickly.
We come back into the rear. They say you can rest. So we were dirty and nasty because we don't have shower units and stuff like the rest of the people have. So anyway, we put our clothes in a big barrel and we washed them with GI soap and stuff. So later on that evening, about 4 o'clock, they said, young guys, get saddled up. You're going on patrol. And we said, man, we can't go nowhere. Clothes is all wet. They said, you better dry them out quick. And we was trying to dry in front of the barrel. So they give us our operation order and the password, and we took off. We went through the lines, and we walked from about 7 o'clock at night. Some guys were walking along there in the clothes with ice. We went through the lines. We went out about 15 miles, and we got over top of this village. We seen the village. Two lead houses had a machine gun with two guys under there. We had the two men, Tank Clark was one, and some, they come down and get under that machine gun. We were sitting up at a lot, and the moonlight was out bright. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. So they reached up and they snatched that machine gun off, and the guys jumped off the other side and they ran. They said, all right, cut loose. And we went through there, and we were shooting right and left. Old dude walking shot a pig. So anyway, these two little kids come out there, and they were ram, 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 ram. They said, what the devil those kids come from? And I won't call his name, but one of our sergeants was aiming at him. And I said, oh, no, don't do that. Don't do it. And he said, if we don't kill him now, we're going to come back over here in 10 years. You got to do it. I said, no, please don't do that. So we went on through. A little while later, this guy come out in his long johns. He come running out there. He had a pistol holster in the belt. And I think the pistol was still in the holster. And he come out there with a surprised look on his face. Like, what are you guys doing here? And I was going to get him, but somebody got him before I did. Boom, boom. He fell down with the same gun in his hand. Somebody took a pistol. And we went on through. Went out the other side, come on down. And I thought we was almost home when Pop Jones, he was walking in front of me with a machine gun belt on, and I heard this noise, one for you, one for me. I said, what the devil's going on? Pop Jones, what you doing? I ain't carrying all this ammunition back with me. And he was pulling the bullets out of the machine gun belt. One for you. I said, man, you better hold that stuff. And about that time, machine gun opened up on top of the hill. I said, I know this was too good to be true. So it was a captain from the S2 section. You used to always want to go with us. He said, I think Lieutenant Pryor was in charge. He said, Lieutenant, said, give me a couple of men. He said, I'll take care of this. And he said, okay. He named two men. They went up on the hill. And you heard something go, bang, bang, bang. So a little while later, he come back down. He was carrying some parts, parts of the gun, and some jackets, all bloody and everything. He said, I took care of them, said they all gone.
We'll let you have the last word here, sir.
But we had a guy named James Oakley, and he had a lot of equipment on. He had two BAR belts. That's one is enough. He had two BAR belts, and he fell through the ice. And this year, Corinne was a guide, our interpreter, stripped to his waist, went down there, tried to bring him up. But he had too much equipment on.
Couldn't pull him up.
Couldn't pull him up. Did the best that we could.
Thank you, gentlemen. I know that you have tons of more stories, and we should have been listening for the past 60 years, but at least we've started to listen to you. And we thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.